we welcome into the program, friend of the program, author Colin Fleming. Look, you want the perfect Christmas gift or the perfect book for yourself for the holiday season? Get a copy of Colin's book, Scrooge. Yes, it's about the movie. It's about so much more than that. And look, if they gouge you at Amazon, go to your local bookstore and have them order it for you. You will be happy that you did. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Kimball?
Outstanding. Yourself?
Oh, you know, that's a fruitless query with me, isn't it, sir? So I'll just say the same, and thanks for asking.
Well, I know that you've been battling a little health stuff there, but you are a Zulu warrior. What's the current status?
I don't even know what I say sometimes. The hard stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, shortness of breath and shallow breathing and the pulse going all the time. And I've decided to think that it's terror and panic attacks from being in the meat grinder constantly. And, right? I mean, what could it be? I can't be that bad with the stairs, although I've been derelict for the past few days. But we have the number one day for heart attacks coming up on Christmas, Kimball, so I guess we'll see where I'm at Christmas morning.
You'd be fine. You have the heart of a lion, maybe two.
Yes, yes. Cast me. If you're going to remake Wizard of Oz, let me be that guy. Let me be all of them and the Judy Garland character.
Well, I think you would do a fabulous job at any of those. Would you be the lion? I don't know. If I were to cast you, you might be the wizard. I would... That would be good. But I could see you could also be the scarecrow, I think.
I could. The scarecrow is who she meets first, and she's unabashed about him being her favorite.
Right.
And the few people who don't hate me and want me dead tend to esteem me greatly, although they don't say it to me often. And I think that I would probably be him, because people don't have... namby-pamby kind of feelings towards me one way or the other, and I'd want to be Dorothy's favorite, frankly. That would be important to me.
I can see that completely. Well, let's talk about a number of holiday offerings that you've selected for us today. I enjoyed them all. The terrific Lux Radio broadcast, and interesting to me that this was from March of 1947, the radio version of It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, and that's wonderful.
The things that we think are Christmas things weren't always Christmas things.
Right.
Another good example, like really probably the two best examples, are It's a Wonderful Life and Handel's Messiah. Everyone who goes to their one occasional classical music concerts, it's usually Messiah, and they think it's something that Handel wrote for the season, but it was more of an Easter deal. And It's a Wonderful Life, when it came out, I was reading a review from the New York Times today, and it wasn't gotten. It was thought of as quaint and sort of folksy. And I feel like critically it wasn't received as what it was at the time. Now, the way that I would describe the film more than anything, and this puts it in same bucket in a way as is Scrooge, which I wrote the book on, is I think of it as a horror film. I think of it as so unremittingly terror-centric in its final third until the clouds clear at the end. But it is having at you. It's grinding at you hard. And I think I mentioned to you I'd walked into a theater. Yeah, I did. And the trailer was playing for a revival screening at the Brattle. And it was like coming in on the Wolfman, but scarier, much scarier. It is that scene on the bridge in the film, and he's going to jump, and it is the blood on the lid. It's not even a bloodless film, and which was typical at the time, but you have a little bit of blood. It's just unremitting. The suicide. This is what we're dealing with. This is a man who's given so much to other people that he has nothing left. He's shorn of hope. And so to hear James Stewart step back into that character and have to do it on the radio in a truncated version, you get a deeper appreciation, I think, for the rhythm of the film. Because when we do get to the part what is the final third of the film when it's I Wish I Was Never Been Born, which is such a great idea to enact that. He's really giving it all his all, James Stewart. He's not holding back it in any degree whatsoever. But without the buildup of the film, it's not the same in impact. And certain choices are made. It's not Zuzu's petals. It's Zuzu's bell, so we can have everything dovetail with the angel getting his wings and all that. But it's one hell of a listen.
Yeah, and how really cool it must have been that here are these two actors that starred in this film, and now they're bringing those same characters just, I think, less than a year later to a radio production.
Kimball, as you know, I'm a man who knows everything, and we were just talking about The Wizard of Oz. On Christmas Day, 1950, Judy Garland, remember, she was a teenager in 1939 when she was Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, did a radio adaptation of the movie. Same idea, but quite different, because we have James Stewart a few months later. Okay, he's still that guy, that actor, that person, that age. Imagine if you were Judy Garland and you're coming back to that role a decade plus after the fact. That is one juxtaposition. So this was the norm at the time, in the middle of the century, that you would get these. It would have to be a very successful film. There are the first two Thin Mans, for instance, that we have radio adaptations. But it's not Lever to Heaven. It's far from even most successful films. It's kind of the bell cow films, or what were thought of that at the time. So bring them back. Late winter. It's still even the winter, and out he comes again. And we only have him and the two main characters, so we don't get really anyone else. But I mean, they're the ones that you need for that radio adaptation.
And they were great. But I think it was Victor Moore who played Uncle Billy. But and he's fine. But he's no Thomas Mitchell. But who was?
What a great cast that you had in the original. In the original too, and when the action was the only the movie and the ensemble, and I mean, there's just so much that was progressive about that film. And one of the scenes, I think it's perhaps the most erotic scene in all of American cinema, maybe not international cinema, because you have that beach sequence in Bergman's Persona, but when Mary and James Stewart, they're on the phone and they're listening in together. They have to bring their heads close together. Do you remember how
yeah.
Her mom is upstairs? And it doesn't quite work as well on radio. I mean, it couldn't. But and they're talking to Sam Wainwright, and it's this weird sort of romantic configuration playing out. And they end up hanging up on Wainwright. And you watch that in the theater, and it really takes you aback. It's ahead of its time in how emotionally denuded that sequence was, that these people, they can't keep the walls in place any longer. They throw themselves over the tops of those walls and at each other. It's such this, it's almost like something we shouldn't be able to observe. It's voyeuristic in a way, but it's also this something warm and invigorating and inspiriting and encouraging comes over us as we bear witness to this crucible moment of not just a relationship, but a friendship and a domestic partnership. And while he's going to sort of be saved by Clarence Oddbody's intervention, he's saved all the more by her. The film is her film, ultimately. She's the hero of the film.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to it, check it out from 1947, the Lux Radio Theater, terrific broadcast of It's a Wonderful Life. And then we're talking with Colin Fleming, of course, here on Downtown, an absolutely fabulous version of A Christmas Carol. And I don't know, it wasn't the Mercury Theater. This was sponsored by Campbell's Soup, but it was a whole lot of the regulars. Orson Welles in A Christmas Carol, an appearance by Joseph Cotten as nephew Fred. Man, this was great.
Mercury Theater is really, we can apply it. It's just a catch-all for the acting troupe. So a lot of times the actual label Mercury Theater wasn't used, but we know whom we're talking about with that. And the way this works is most people who know an Orson Welles, what they think is the Orson Welles radio production of A Christmas Carol, know the 1939 version with Lionel Barrymore, from who's later going to be Mr. Potter, Old Man Potter, in It's a Wonderful Life. And he was the dean, if you will, of American Scrooges. That was his role. And the Potter character is a Scrooge redux, in a way. Mm-hmm. So without the same Scrooge, as we've talked about before, he has more humanity closer to the surface than we tend to think. And you especially see that with Alistair Sim. He's not that far off from finding himself again, from redemption. But they didn't. Lionel Barrymore had something else to do in 1938. And this suited the strengths of Orson Welles so well, because he was at his best when he had to rally, and he would dump coffee and bourbon down himself, and he would stay up for 36 hours and create and invent. And he plays this whiny, in a way, adenoidal Scrooge. He's also the narrator. And his Scrooge isn't that far removed from his George Amberson from another radio play of The Magnificent Ambersons, which is going to predate the famous film that's going to get him booted out of RKO. So it has this, it works better, even though Welles is lesser as a Scrooge, because it's like on Christmas when the kids are over and you're all going to be in a play together, and it's all for one and one for all, that kind of camaraderie. And he makes up the gap in his narration. If you listen to the two back to back, it's a completely different level of performance, or somewhat different level of performance in the narration of the 1938 version. It's homier. It's like being under the comforter with a flashlight, and you're looking for the radio station and you find this, and it's just, it's cozier. It's the best radio adaptation out of many of this novella.
Yeah, it was great. I'm going to listen to it again on Christmas Eve, I think, this year. Now let's talk Beatles, who did, what was it, 3 years in a row that they released a Christmas recording for their fans?
No, you got them every year, excepting the piecemeal year of 1962. So 1964 was the second one. 1963 is the first one. In some ways, it's the best because it's the most fun, and they don't know that they're going to last, and they're getting bang for their buck and having a good time. The timeline is, so they recorded in 63, or most of them, in the fall, and they hadn't hit America yet. That wasn't going to be until February of 1964. So this is at the end of 1964. It's during Beatles for Sale. So they've A Hard Day's Night, their album has come out, A Hard Day's Night, the film, they've done Ed Sullivan, they've toured North America, and they're in a different place than they were even the year before when they were the biggest thing around that time in England. So it's a way of thanking the fans. It's kind of a weird thing, I've always felt, thanking someone for, do you know what I mean? Like, I try to take that into consideration, because my attitude, in a way, is like, I don't want to say it's like, well, screw you, you're the one who made out, you got the good stuff. But I think you kind of think that way if you're really the best at something and you're competitive and you have a sense of propriety, maybe. So they're there doing their thing and thanking everyone. They're being sarcastic about it the entire time, but they're just on the right side of sardonic that it sounds in good faith, and it's winsome.
Yeah, and when they do a little singing, I will call it that, but they do a little riff on Yesterday, and man, it's a hoot that even when they're fooling around, and it's a little pitchy at times, but then, you know, like out of the blue, they find those great harmonies, even when they're fooling around.
Yeah. The 1965 was the link I sent you, and at the very beginning, yeah, you get all of them doing warbling Yesterday. And if you think about it, that's really the only time that It's almost a trivia question for a highly qualified Beatles fan. Like, when was the only time that they all sang together on Yesterday? Because what you would start to do is think about when they were in Blackpool and there was that live television performance there. Did they do it in Ed Sullivan? Did they do it at the Budokan in 1966? No. And it would be here. Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fun to listen to. Absolutely. There is a super deluxe expanded remastered version of A Charlie Brown Christmas, and it's got some wonderful different takes. And, you know, if you appreciate what that music meant, not only to the television special, but even in the world of jazz, this is a wonderful chance to hear something different.
Oh, yeah. And so much more than it's. I think this is probably, in terms of popular music, this is my favorite Christmas music of all. Although, when I was at Starbucks the other day, Burl Ives, and he remade everything for the album, he came on and he was singing Holly Jolly Christmas, and I'm not going to lie, Kimball, it was a struggle for the Sea Dog not to stand up, overturn his table, and start doing his manic Charleston, which is the only dance I do. I do it to everything. And so that's pretty good. But there's something about the minor key, the melancholia of these Peanuts recordings. And they go right through you, but they also stay with you. And the way I look at this box set, because someone might think, do I really need 8 takes of Christmas Time and the vocal version and the non-vocal version? It's almost like you have a favorite part of a forest. You're like, this is the copse I like. This is my preferred patch. And it's pretty great. But then you go a little bit further out into the forest and you find really great things there, too, that are of a piece with your favorite copse. And I think this box set is like that. You can just lose yourself in a Christmas wonderland. Anyone who reads the blog or has probably heard me reference it on here, I'm trying to get my house back in Rockport. And one of the things that is pretty neat is when you drive up to Cape Ann, on the side of the road throughout the journey, and it's been a while, I don't know if it's still this way, but when you looked into the forest, there were Christmas decorations on the trees. And I just thought, the level of dedication, who did that? It's almost magic type of idea and charming. And I think of this box set that way. You're out there and there's a tree and another tree and another tree and another tree. And then there's a tree with a couple decorations on it. And it just makes everything worth living for when you see something like that. And I guess that would sort of be my tagline too for this music. It makes you want to be around to be able to keep hearing it.
You wrote a wonderful piece in the blog about Linus and Lucy, and I don't want to paraphrase you. Do you remember what you wrote about that particular moment in that song?
Yeah, I do. I remember that I called it out in the Lucy Instamost the most. I know, and the exact language of that does matter because it's such a precise claim that I made, and I don't want to try and paraphrase it either. But I gave the timestamp of this most indelible, uplifting moment in all of American music. It's the length of, like, it, you know what it is right away. It's like a second. And it only happens, and it's funny too, because it only happens in the song once. And it's the type of thing that in your memory, it reoccurs 3 or 4 times in the song, but it doesn't. It's just that one time. And we've talked before about how the piano is a percussion instrument. This is a good example of just how percussive the piano can be. But I think it's also a musical sequence that everyone, no matter how disconnected we are, in my writing career, I've learned that there is essentially nothing that many people will not know. There are people who can work for a magazine about music and who won't know the Rolling Stones. I mean, like, have heard of them. It's not that uncommon. It was something that I wouldn't have believed before I was doing what I was doing for as long as I've done it. So I apply the asterisk. But that moment in Linus and Lucy, and people don't even know the name of the song, is something that I feel is in everyone. It's triggered. It's brought out. It's, play is pushed, and it comes back to life, that memory. But
I've got it here, so I get it exact. The most sweetly pleasing moment in the history of American music.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And part of the reason I think it's accurate is, what else could it be?
Well, I read that and I thought, okay, I like Linus and Lucy, but I don't know, is Colin being a bit hyperbolic here? And then, of course, I played it and I got to the 35-second mark and I went, oh God, oh absolutely, is there's nothing better, there's nothing more satisfying in that.
No, and I never have done hyperbole. I've never. To me, hyperbole is something that's put into practice when the arrows aren't in the quiver, so to speak, and that's not how I am. I would say something because I've thought a lot about it, and I've believed it to be true. And something like this, a lot of times, what we know comes down to what something, and so what else could it be than that moment and that. And that particular song, da 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 da, and then it kind of creates this polyphonic rhythm. It doubles back on itself, and you know what? It's also imbued with narrative. Think about this: Linus and Lucy, they're brother and sister. That's the sound of the sibling dynamic. But it's more than that. We are, I feel, tasked. I know people don't do this; they don't live this way. With being each other's brother and sister. So we're moving beyond that dynamic of the family unit to something larger. And when you look at it that way, and the Linus of all people is involved, someone who, if he was listening right now, I think would be nodding along and sucking his thumb, then, yeah, I think that claim is at least pretty feasible.
Let's listen to another piece of a pretty wonderful American music right here from, I believe, 1954.
Is that you, Santa Claus? Gifts I'm preparing for some Christmas sharing, but I pause because hang in my stocking, I can hear a knocking. Is that you, Santa Claus?
You've got a new piece for Jazz Times, and you talk about Louis Armstrong and his Christmas works and how great it would have been had he recorded a Christmas album. And I love your idea. How about an album that is one side of Armstrong and one side Billie Holiday? Wow.
Yeah, Louis Armstrong, you would think, because he recorded a lot of albums and a lot of different kinds of albums, quasi-concept albums, and you'd think there would be multiple Christmas sets. How could there not be? But there were really three Christmas singles, and he recorded also duets with Ella Fitzgerald, and you can put some of that material in there. And this song is so Zat You, it's Z-A-T, so it's the demotic. It's urban speak. It's not cleaned up for the white folks, Kimball.
Mm.
It's an urban African American all are welcome vibe to this song. With Armstrong had a great ability to sing in that scenery chomping way without actually nibbling at all on the scenery. because his singing worked so well. I would sometimes I daydream about going out for a coffee and knowing somebody, and we sit down and we discuss for like an hour whether Louis Armstrong was a better trumpet player or a better singer. I think you can make a real argument for a better singer. And then we're getting into some messed up territory because no one was better than Armstrong on the trumpet. Hardly anyone's ever been better on any instrument than Armstrong was on the trumpet. So it's soulful, it's funny, it's sly, it's full of winks, and I don't know, it's just so urban and rhythm and bluesy, black. And that's not what you were getting, really, in mid-century Christmas music.
Well, no, not at all. And you write in the piece that something to love about Armstrong is that he's so weird.
He is. He's good weird. And people, I remember one time when someone described something I wrote that way. I think it was like Sega Man and Between Cloud and Horizon. It wasn't weird to me. When we use weird, and I'm doing it here a little bit, what we often mean is it's not the same old Wonder Bread. It doesn't actually make it weird, weird. I mean, not like there's anything wrong with that. I have a phrase. Weird is the best when weird works. And anything that is great, a Christmas Carol, Orson Welles, A Hard Day's Night, Star Wars, the first one, is weird. It was weird when it came out. It's a Wonderful Life was weird. Well, think about It's a Wonderful Life. It's almost two pictures in one. I mean, the shift in the tone. It's two different movies, but how do they not belong together? That's weird. The whole conceit at the end is weird. Everything about it's weird. Doesn't mean that it can't be loved by 4 billion people. Those are the things that are. Louis Armstrong was weird. You ever hear someone sing like that? You ever hear someone play like that? Mozart was weird. Bach was weird.
Well, weird just means it stands out from everything else around it in its time.
It does. And now we are so terrified of anything that's unlike us because it causes us to call who we are into question. So we apply weird. You hear, like, you've seen the word weirdo making a comeback, used as a pejorative, but it's really misapplied. That's not what weird means. But in comparison to everything out at the time, Louis Armstrong, or you mentioned Billie Holiday, was weird. Ella Fitzgerald, John Coltrane, like, what isn't someone who's Think of everyone who was around at the time of Dickens, all of these best-selling authors. Can you name any of them? Right? I mean, you remember him, but think of if you were Dickens and you were in an MFA program right now and you workshopped your idea and that idea hadn't existed and you came up with these ghosts. You'd be drummed out because it's not quote-unquote social realism about growing up rich in New York. But people would think you were weird, but he made a mint. He's still making a mint. If you notice in the broadcast with Orson Welles, he talks about how long the novella has been around, and he says almost 100 years. So think of that. It's now we're inching our way towards 200 years, and it was in a way sort of fresh, and it's still the same. It's this cottage industry unto itself.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Downtown. Colin will be off next week, so we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks here. But I'll be thinking of you Christmas Eve when I listen to Orson Welles once again, my friend.
Okay, I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Fleming, every week on Downtown. Check out the Many Moments More blog, Colin's website at colinflemminglit.com.